Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by
Natalie and Aaron met on CatholicSingles.com after they realized that they needed to find someone who shared their faith. Meet other faithful Catholics on the original Catholic dating site. Download our app today for free.
Looking for a way to build daily prayer discipline? Seen the rise in mindfulness meditation, but not sure if it is possible to meditate in a way that's consistent with your Catholic faith? Just looking for a way to breathe new life into your existing prayer routine? No matter what you're looking for, Holo is here to help. Holo is a Catholic prayer and meditation app that helps users deepen their relationship with God through audio-guided contemplative prayer sessions. From meditations on the daily gospel, to the rosary, to daily examines, Holo has something for everyone. Holo is the number one Catholic app in the U.S. It is free to download and has permanently free content, but you can also check out all of the premium sessions for 30 days, risk-free, by signing up at www.holo.app/breadbox.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger. Today we have with us Trent Horn, who after his conversion to the Catholic faith earned master's degrees in the fields of theology, philosophy, and bioethics. He serves as a staff apologist for Catholic Answers, where he specializes in teaching Catholics to graciously and persuasively engage those who disagree with him. Trent models that approach each week on the radio program Catholic Answers Live and on his own podcast, The Council of Trent. He's also been invited to debate at UC Berkeley, UC Santa Barbara, and Stanford University. Trent's an adjunct professor of apologetics at the Holy Apostles College, has written for the National Catholic Bioethics Quarterly, and has written nine books, including Answering Atheism, The Case for Catholicism, and Why We're Catholic, Our Reasons for Faith, Hope, and Love. Today, we're discussing his latest book, Can a Catholic Be a Socialist? The answer is no. Here's why. Welcome to the show, Trent.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, you're welcome. So I guess to start our time together today, what drew you to tackling this particular topic and writing this book?
Well, I saw that there was a large increase in people's fascination with socialism, especially among my generation. Even many Catholics who were normally faithful Orthodox Catholics who seemed to think that there's some kind of a mandate from the papal encyclicals on economics and others that we ought to support socialism, that in order, the only way for us to help the poor, to fulfill Jesus' mandate to help the poor, is to promote a socialist political ideology. And so I wanted to write a book in response to that, and I wanted to make sure that I wasn't stepping too far out of my own wheelhouse, which is why I enlisted the help of my co-author, Catherine Pakalik, who holds a PhD in economics and teaches at Catholic University of America. She's also written peer-reviewed articles on the papal encyclicals and what they teach about socialism. So being able to combine our efforts, I think we have a good resource for people to apply church teaching to these political and economic questions.
Absolutely. And from reading it, I would have to agree with that. And one of the things is this starts with basics. For those of us listening that just think of socialism as a word and don't realize what it is, can you give us a brief overview of what the concept of socialism is?
Right. So socialism is not the idea that government provides public benefits to people or social programs. Some people think that capitalism is just the idea of government never intervening in the economy at all. And that's just not the case. There is no such thing as laissez-faire capitalism. truly hands-off, because capitalism only works if there is a government that exists to honor contracts, be able to adjudicate complaints about fraud between business people. Socialism is not that. Socialism is when the production of goods and services, the means of production, are placed primarily in the hands of government. Socialists like to say that the people own the means of production rather than companies or private businesses. But in practical history, the people just usually ends up being government that produces goods and services, allocates wealth, and redistributes wealth based on people's needs, alleged needs, rather than the means of production being in the hands of private firms and private actors to be able to exchange with one another on a free market. So to give a perspective, government providing food stamps is not socialism. That is a social welfare program. If government ran all of the supermarkets and food stores and there weren't private business, private alternatives, and government just set the prices and produced food and distributed to people based on what they thought the need was, that would be socialism. And so, in fact, collective food production distribution is a hallmark of socialism, and it's something that has brought ruin to previous socialist regimes like the Soviet Union and Maoist China.
Mm. So now that we have that established, I keep, at least during this election cycle, keep hearing this word, when referring to a certain candidate, he's not socialist, he's democratic socialism is what he believes in. So is there a difference, or is it the same thing and they're just trying to get fancy by naming it something else?
It depends who you ask. Now, our book does not make any commentary on any currently serving U.S. politicians. Mm-hmm. We don't make any judgments about who's involved in any political races at this time.
Right.
But the term democratic socialist comes from Michael Harrington, who actually worked with Dorothy Day as part of the Catholic workers movement in the 1950s before he left because he said that was as far left as you could go in the church and I wanted to go further. So Harrington wanted an alternative to Soviet style socialism. And there are some people who argue and say, well, we just want worker cooperatives and things like that and more government benefits for people. The problem is with democratic socialism, it's either essentially just, promoting large social welfare programs, which once again is not socialism. There are many capitalists who believe in large social welfare programs. That's essentially how Denmark and Sweden operate, is that they have a market economy, they're capitalists, but they redistribute a lot of their wealth through social welfare programs. And there are trade-offs when you choose to do that. So it's either not socialism or it's a Trojan horse for socialism. There are writers like at Jacobin Magazine and others who see democratic socialism as a means to one day get to full-fledged socialism that eliminates capitalism, eliminates the right to private property, eliminates the right to inheritance, and undermines the role of the family in being the central structure of society. So democratic socialism is just a very malleable word. That's why we stick to socialism as it's been defined and understood throughout the papal encyclicals for 150 years.
Got it. Now, the big question to me, and it's one that actually drew me to this book, and it's probably going to draw a lot of people to it, is why has this conversation on socialism returned in recent years?
Well, I think it's returned, and you know what? You may see it more here in the future. It pops up frequently during times of economic trial. The last time socialism was extremely popular in the U.S. was in the 1930s as a result of the Great Depression. People believed that banks were not trustworthy, that capitalism led to volatile markets. And so during the 30s, they believed that socialism and communism was necessary to prevent poverty. And we see a lot of people, young people, have gravitated towards this since the Great Recession. And if we plunge into a recession or a depression because of the coronavirus pandemic, you may see a lot more people arguing for socialism and government planning of the economy as a result. So when people see volatility in markets, they think that capitalism causes that. And it's funny, I hear people saying, look at the grocery stores and you see empty shelves. And they say, this is what capitalism looks like in a crisis. And I say, yeah, And guess what? That's what socialism looks like all the time. Rather, capitalism is what's providing the ability that people can see, oh, there's an increased demand in a product. Well, private actors are able to respond to that demand and try to ramp up production to be able to meet it. Socialism, if you hate shortages now, if you hate shortages during this pandemic, that's the way. And you read in our book in chapter 19, I think chapter 18 or 19, we talk about Venezuela. Mm-hmm. The socialist government there caused shortages of toilet paper, eggs. You know, you can't find food, water. The average Venezuelan over the course of a year in Venezuela lost something like 20 pounds because of food shortages there. So that's our book. We want to show both in principle why it's wrong, Catholics can't support it, and also historically why it fails every single time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and another argument to that of the empty shelves right now is because we are not necessarily capitalism, but we're a free country. We, in some ways, allow that to happen because of the freedoms we have, and it's us, the people, that create that condition because we're overreacting.
Right, yeah, and that's what happens is that here's the thing with economics and what people don't understand is they think that, oh, and this happens even among some Catholics who endorse what they think is an alternative to socialism and capitalism, is that people think that if there was just someone who could plan everything and just direct the production of goods and how they're allocated, and then if someone just planned everything, it would just function properly. But as we show in our book, that's just impossible. It can't be done. And that's what the philosopher and economic theorist Friedrich Hayek discovered back in the 1940s. He talked about the problem of knowledge, that the knowledge of knowing how much you have to produce, how much things cost, what's the need or demand in different places. No one has all of that, so it's impossible to plan for it, and that's what creates shortages. The analogy we use in the book is this. If you watch a flock of birds, how does the flock know where to go? Like, you look at starlings. There'll be flocks of 2,000 starling birds, and they'll all turn to the right immediately. But there's no single bird telling them all where to go. It would be impossible for one bird or one person to make that direction. But rather, what's happening is each of the birds in the flock, their wing movements send a signal through the flock, and that naturally directs the entire flock to move in the correct direction. And that's what happens in market-based economies through things like prices. So the big problem is, how do you set prices? That's the big issue. Some people will say that the price for labor, i.e. wages, are too low, or the price for certain goods is too high. So government should just come in and set reasonable prices for goods and reasonable prices for labor so people aren't paid too little. But you just can't do that because nobody knows what things truly cost. Prices reflect natural supply and demand of goods and services. And when you try to go in and just impose it by force, it ends up leading to shortages and leads to economic disaster.
Mm-hmm. So why does it seem, and you kind of alluded this to this in the first question, why does it seem that, you know, it seems an increasing amount of Catholics today are falling for this mindset or propaganda of the benefits of socialism when the church specifically says it's not the right path forward?
The church says which is not the right path forward? Socialism?
Socialism, yeah.
Well, that's something that has been put forward unanimously in papal encyclicals on the subject since the 1850s, most famously in Pope Leo XIII's encyclical Rerum Novarum, where he talks about it, how the main tenet of socialism, that goods are owned in community, that the community owns goods rather than individuals and families being able to acquire private property and pass it on to their children, that has to be rejected. Later on, as socialism morphed into communism and how it was lived out under the Soviet Union, Pope Pius XI said that communism is intrinsically evil and no Christian could participate in it to save civilization whatsoever for any reason. So the church has been unanimous. And as we show in our book, this continues in through the modern era, up to John Paul II and even Pope Francis, who says that Marxism is simply wrong.
Mm-hmm. I hear in some circles, some people kind of try and tie Jesus and his followers as a model of sorts for socialism. What are the arguments against that, and how can we refute those claims?
Right. And what we could say here in reply to that is we should say, look, Jesus and his apostles, they practiced charity. They did not practice mandatory communism. So we can say that Jesus told us to help the poor, but he didn't give us a specific means to do that. He didn't say that government existed solely for the purpose of collecting resources to distribute them. He commanded us to give to the poor. And people can reasonably debate what are the best means to do that, but Jesus didn't give us a political program in order to do that. And when you look at the early church, it's true. Many of the apostles and Christians, they lived in community and shared their goods with one another. They practiced charity, but it wasn't mandated. And that's obvious because when you read in St. Paul's letter to the Corinthians, Paul asked the Corinthians to contribute to a fund, to a collection to help the church in Judea that was suffering from a famine. And he said, I do not do this by means of compulsion because God loves a cheerful giver. He appealed to their generosity. If the early church practiced communism, Paul could just say, all right, everyone, turn over all your money, and then we're going to distribute it to the church in Judea who needs it. But he didn't do that because that's not how the church operated. The church operated by practicing charity, not communism or socialism.
And I thought it was really interesting in the one chapter, and if I'm portraying this wrong, please correct me. The rise of capitalism in some ways created a perfect storm for socialism to find some footing, or at least helped it to get along in some ways, didn't it?
You said that the church came along to help capitalism?
No, the rise of capitalism itself in some ways created the perfect environment for socialism to come about.
It did, and that's what we have to understand. That's why when we talk about in the book, like people will say Jesus was the first socialist, and say, I'll say, no, that's not true. Socialism emerged in the 19th century, first through utopian idealists and then through scientific socialism from people like Frederick Engels and Karl Marx. So it was these individuals that promoted the socialism that we know today. But we try to show it's important to understand why people would promote socialism is that as capitalism got off the ground, capitalism is a tool. It's a tool discovered in nature that allows people to exchange goods, grow companies and businesses, and be able to produce wealth. It's a tool, so it can be misused. It's not perfect. It's not given to us by God. It's a human tool that we've developed. And so there are excesses to that. And so we talk in the book about how as capitalism and industry flourished in England and Europe, there were abysmal factory conditions, people feeling that they were being exploited, labor was being exploited. And we see this around the world that a lot of places go through a kind of phase where they start with kind of rural agriculture. They go through a kind of dirty, degraded situation of basic capitalism. But as people's wages increase, they tend to demand better lifestyles. And so those countries naturally become cleaner and healthier over time. And so it's just kind of a phase to go through. But during that particular phase, which is what, you know, Pope Leo XIII was addressing in his encyclical, some people feel like it's not worth it, even though that's kind of the necessary path towards producing wealth and stability in a modern economy.
Good stuff. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Trent Horn to cover more of his book, Can a Catholic Be a Socialist? The answer is no, and here's why. You're listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. We'll be right back.
I feel silly trying to make up prayers myself. My mind starts to wander as I'm speaking to God. I just don't have time to pray. Do you recognize yourself in any of these statements? If so, we have a book for you. In Pray Fully, best-selling authors Michelle Fanley and Emily Jaminet share the rewards and frustrations of their own prayer journeys to create a practical guide that combines testimonies, tips, and journaling space to help you spend quality time with God. Whether you want to learn how to pray aloud in a group or stop your mind from wandering during prayer, Fanley and Jaminet have practical advice and the real-life experience to help you overcome obstacles to everyday prayer. Head over to AveMariaPress.com and use code LEARN2PRAY, that's LEARN2PRAY, to get 20% off your copy today.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf. We're here with Trent Horn talking about his latest book, Can a Catholic be a socialist. And Trent, you mentioned in the book, when you're writing about Pope Pius XI, that socialism rejects the principle of subsidiarity. And for those of us not familiar, can you define what that is, subsidiarity?
Right. So the principle of subsidiarity a principle of Catholic social teaching that says that actions and responsibilities that can be provided for or taken care of by a lower organization ought to be, and that one ought not appeal to a higher level of authority within an organization unless absolutely necessary. So when it comes to social doctrine, when it comes to society, local and state governments, local jurisdictions should provide for themselves first before requiring assistance from state or federal or international authorities to be able to do that. You know, when you look at life in your parish, like if there's a problem at your parish, you go to the direct person involved. You don't go to the bishop immediately. You don't go to the Pope immediately. You have to start lower down in the chain, essentially. Mm-hmm. So, but socialism denies the ability of a local community, whether it's a family or a city or a state, to be able to sustain itself, and believes that the entire community as a whole has to sustain one another. And so this rejects the principle of subsidiarity. Another problem is that under socialism, it destroys family bonds. So under socialism, true socialism, your obligations to other citizens are equal to every other citizen. You don't have a greater obligation to your family, for example. So that's why socialists from the very beginning were opposed to the law of inheritance, whereas Pope Leo XIII said that a man has the right to own, and this time land was the big source of wealth when mm-hmm. Pope Leo was writing, to own land, to subdue it, to till it, to produce wealth from that, and then to be able to give that wealth to his children to be able to provide for them. But socialists said, no, we don't want that. The state will give children where they need. Parents don't need to do that. You just give your fruits of your labor to the state, and then the state will allocate it to people based on their need. But that's not what the church teaches. The church teaches that families have an obligation to provide for themselves, and the state should step in only when a family is simply unable to do that for themselves because of hardship or unforeseen circumstances, not because the state ought to just pool wealth and resources to distribute them to people. I guess what I would say also when it comes to socialism, why it's wrong, is that it treats equals unequally, and it treats unequals equally. Mm-hmm. So the idea under socialism and what Marx wanted with communism was that there be no classes, there be no rich, no poor, so everybody has the same amount of wealth. But now you might think, oh, well, that's fair. That's what a Christian should support. Everyone should have the same, but it's not. Pope Leo XIII made it clear that socialism would sink us to the same dead level. People should be treated, have equal dignity, equal rights, but not equal wealth because people are unequal. For example, I don't deserve to be paid the same amount for playing basketball as LeBron James because mm-hmm. I'm terrible at it. And he shouldn't be paid what you would pay me to play, which would be nothing. We're unequal when it comes to playing basketball, so he deserves to be compensated more. Much the same way other people have acquired skills and practices and talents and abilities that are compensated in different ways, because as human beings, we are all very different. Because we are unequal in talents and abilities, we need one another. And so we form a human interconnected web, so to speak, where we support one another. That's undermined by socialism that just says, well, the state will just support everyone and make sure everyone is equal, when we're not equal in many of these ways. And to treat us as equals as such would be telling a lie mm-hmm. about us as human beings.
So we've kind of established that socialism has downfalls, is not the right way to go. What prompted this global spread of socialism, and why do governments continue to practice and experiment with it, even though history shows it's not the answer?
Well, I think that the main problem is that people have this sense. They believe that, oh, well, people think often with their intuitions, rather than being able to put pencil to paper and examine data to see what comes about. And so I think that, you know, it's been said that the road to hell is paved with good intentions, that people have these good intentions when it comes to, you know, promoting ending poverty, helping people to live dignified lives. But they try just this shortcut that never really works. In the book, I quote one of Aesop's fables, one of my favorite. It's called Belling the Cat. And so it's about a bunch of mice who are terrified of a cat, and they wanted a solution to their problem. So one of the mice says, okay, I'll put a bell. Someone will put a bell. We'll put a bell around the cat's neck so I always know when he's coming. And everyone cheers. It's a great solution. And they praise the mouse who came up with it. But then an old mouse steps up and he says, okay, it's a great plan, but I have one question. Who's going to bell the cat? And then everyone's quiet. Mm-hmm. And the moral, Aesop's moral, is this. It's easy to propose impossible solutions. And I think that's what happens with socialism. We say, oh, it'd be great. Just we end poverty. We just do things this way. But it doesn't work. And our human nature just won't allow it. But to give you another example we use in the book, socialism requires everybody acting their best to be perfectly altruistic to provide for society. But when have you known people to be perfectly altruistic? Rather, when people own their own property and can manage it, they treat it better. That's why the public restroom at the park is always dirtier than your bathroom at home. At least one would hope so, because guess what? Everyone can use the public bathroom at the park, but it's not truly theirs. It's owned by everyone, so nobody thinks they have the obligation to clean it. But if you own the bathroom, then you feel the obligation to keep it clean. And that's you know, just one of another lesson why socialism doesn't work.
So we've talked about just wages, and it's kind of ironic we're conducting this interview as this somewhat plays out in the Senate floor today with the coronavirus stimulus package and how they're going to help the American worker. What is a just wage, and what is the church's stance on that?
Sure. What we talk about in the book, because part of socialism, as I said earlier, socialism ultimately comes down to, a lot of this economic discussion comes down to how you set prices, both the price to buy a good or service and the price to pay a person to do something. So in a sense, a wage is kind of the price for labor. They're not the same thing. Labor is not a mere commodity like a sack of coal, because it's produced by a human being who has dignity and ought to be treated as such. But that's how it happens. So, for example, the cost, like let's say you have, so let's say you have, for example, something that's extremely common, like grass clippings. It's not that expensive. You know, you could sell grass clippings for barely anything because it's so common. Mm-hmm. Diamonds, of course, are very rare, so it's very expensive to buy them. The same is true with labor. Like, the ability to wash a dish is very common, so the price for someone to wash dishes, to pay their labor for that, that's relatively cheap. It's much less common to know how to repair a dishwasher or to repair a sink, so the price for that kind of labor is a lot higher. So when it comes to setting the price for labor, we have to keep those principles in mind. So what we articulate in the book is that there are kind of ceilings for a just wage. There's no way to calculate what is a just wage for any job, because jobs are so different. Rather, what we would say is that it can't be too low so that it ignores the dignity of the worker. But it also can't be too high that it would destroy the business. It has to take into account the dignity of the person who is involved, but also the market conditions related to providing that wage. Also, the other thing that we can do with capitalism to provide people just wages is not necessarily to increase the amount of their wage, but through productive economies, you can bring down the cost of goods and services. So that increases the purchasing power of a person's wage. So 100 years ago, food was much more expensive. An average family spent half their income buying food. Today, food production is so streamlined, a family only spends about 13% of its income on purchasing food. So one way you can increase wages for someone, and it's counterintuitive, is just by bringing down the cost of the things you would buy with the wage. And that's something that socialism doesn't account for, but market-based economies can. Mm.
So in recent months, and I'd say for probably for about a year, this notion of a flat income keeps coming up. And it comes from the same camp that seems to like the idea of socialism, where everybody gets X amount of dollars. Why is that wrong, and where in the world did that come from?
Well, a flat income. I think maybe you're talking about universal basic income.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. UBI is something that has been discussed for a long time by different economists. It's something we don't weigh in on specifically here in our book. It would be distinct from socialism. UBI has been proposed in different ways. Some people have proposed that instead of funding billions of dollars into social welfare programs, government could simply do away with the tens of thousands of bureaucrats that are hired to do that and just take the funds and cut everybody a check. And so everybody would get $1,000 a month or $500 a month from the government, and that would boost the economy. And so that's a proposal that has pluses and minuses involved in it. It's something that we don't weigh in on, so because it's not explicitly socialist.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that it's dangerous to try to approach the level of saying that government ought to pay everyone so that nobody has to work, because the church teaches that there's dignity in work. Work is a part of the human condition, and even if we had not fallen from grace, we would have still worked. It just wouldn't have been as laborious or mm-hmm. toilsome. But work is something that dignifies us, and when people don't have work, they can actually, if they don't have their mind set to something, then they can feel wasted as a human being. And this happens to people that are out of work for a long time. You start to lose a purpose, so to speak. So while we don't settle the issue, it's a policy proposal people can investigate. But it's one, I think, that is fraught with a fair amount of peril in actually how one would apply it. So I think it should be approached very cautiously and skeptically.
Yeah. So in the book, you devote an entire chapter to this, and I think this would be a fitting way to wrap up. You talk about why socialism is not the answer. Is capitalism then the right answer?
Well, the way I would answer that is just it depends. And Pope St. John Paul II answered this question well in his encyclical Centissimus Annus. He said, is capitalism the answer to developing countries around the world that are trying to increase wealth and provide for their citizens? And he said, capitalism is not the answer if it doesn't have a strong juridical framework, if it promotes the exploitation of human beings. But so it's not the answer if that's what you mean by capitalism. But if you mean the ability, and he said he preferred the term market economy as opposed to capitalism, but it amounts to the same thing, the ability to freely exchange goods and services, to grow businesses within a fair legal system that respects property rights. He said that there's nothing in church teaching that is opposed to that, and the church's teaching has never said capitalism is intrinsically evil like socialism is intrinsically evil. We talk in the book how William F. Buckley, he once said this. He said, the problem with capitalism is capitalists. The problem with socialism is socialism. And that neatly reflects what the church has said also. So capitalism is one answer that has been endorsed, provided that it's not corrupted by certain capitalists. But socialism is not the answer because there's no one who can carry it out because it's intrinsically flawed and doesn't respect the basic rights that we have as human beings. That's why Pope Pius XI firmly said in Quadragesima Milano, he said, no good Catholic can be a true socialist.
Mm.
And that's something we think is just as true today as when he said it nearly 100 years ago.
Well, Trent, this is a fascinating read. Where can people find Can a Catholic Be a Socialist?
I would recommend that they go to shop.catholic.com is a great place to get it. You could ask for it at your local Catholic bookstore, but our book, Can a Catholic Be a Socialist, go to shop.catholic.com or to an online book retailer.
Well, Trent, that's all we have time for today. I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule and spending it with us. Any closing thoughts?
No, just in these times of uncertainty, I think we should remember to love the Lord and love our neighbor. And one way we can do that is if we've been blessed financially, we have a moral obligation to help others who are less fortunate. That this is not something government should do, but it is something that we as citizens have a great responsibility before God to care for one another. And we ought to carry that out, especially during this time where many people very soon will be experiencing a lot of economic hardships.
That's great advice. With that, you've been listening.
Go ahead. Once again, it's not social welfare programs are fine. People can debate that, but we ought not turn the entire economy over to socialist planners.
That's even better advice. With that, you've been listening to Off the Shelf. I'm your host, Pete Sox, the Catholic book blogger. Until next time, God bless.
I feel silly trying to make up prayers myself. My mind starts to wander as I'm speaking to God. I just don't have time to pray. Do you recognize yourself in any of these statements? If so, we have a book for you. In Pray Fully, best-selling authors Michelle Fanley and Emily Jaminet share the rewards and frustrations of their own prayer journeys to create a practical guide that combines testimonies, tips, and journaling space to help you spend quality time with God. Whether you want to learn how to pray aloud in a group or stop your mind from wandering during prayer, Fanley and Jaminet have practical advice and the real-life experience to help you overcome obstacles to everyday prayer. Head over to AveMariaPress.com and use code LEARN2PRAY. That's Learn, the number 2, pray, to get 20% off your copy today. Looking for exceptional coffee delivered fresh to your door? We have the answer. Our friends at Grim Bean Coffee produce small-batch artisan coffee using top-tier coffee beans. The coffee is roasted when you order, guaranteeing the freshest coffee possible. Check out Breadbox Roasts, a new line of Catholic-themed coffees available at www.grimbeancoffee.com/Breadbox Media. Experience coffee like never before.